4. Resemblance to a fair trial. 5. Use of simulated evidence. 6. Simulated expert testimony. 7. Non-falsifiability characteristic of evidence. 8. Reversal of polarity. 9. Non-openness. And 10. Use of the loaded question technique. The witch hunt, as characterized by these criteria, is shown to function as a negative normative structure for evaluating argumentation used in particular cases. Most of those characteristics are self-explanatory or consistent with the malleus maleficarum. Reversal of polarity refers to the reversal of the burden of proof. In witch trials, the accused has the burden of proving themselves innocent, rather than the accuser or prosecutor proving guilt. Non-openness refers to being open to the truth of the case. The judge in particular should enter a trial with an open mind, willing to be convinced by the evidence. In a witch trial, they may enter convinced of the guilt of the accused. Modern witch hunts. The witch hunt and burning witches at the stake is now a symbol of backward medieval thinking. Of course, it would be a mistake to think that such things don't happen today. We're perhaps just a bit more sophisticated at hiding them. Most people know about the communist witch hunts of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s. Such methods are now referred to as McCarthyism. McCarthy used fear of communist infiltration into the U.S. government and high society to organize congressional hearings that were little more than modern-day witch hunts. Accusations of being a communist or even just a communist sympathizer were used to defame and destroy many. They were then promised that the devastation to their lives would be minimized if they would just turn in their friends and colleagues. In this climate, accusation was as good as guilt. The communist hysteria of the 1950s now seems distant. Again, we might be tempted to think that witch hunts are a thing of the past. They aren't. In the 1980s came the Satanic Panic. This started as an accusation of ritual abuse in the McMartin Preschool in Southern California. Despite the long investigation and trial that followed, no convictions were made. Dan and Fran Keller were not so lucky. They were convicted in 1991 of sexual assault based on the testimony of children who attended their daycare center. The accusation started when a 3-year-old claimed that Dan Keller, quote, pooped and peed on my head, and suggested sexual assault with a pen. Of course, all suspicions of child abuse need to be investigated. But just because the idea of such crimes is horrific, doesn't mean we can suspend the rules of evidence. In this and other cases, children were interviewed using dubious leading techniques. When their testimony started to get more and more bizarre, including animal sacrifice, murder, and satanic rituals, that should have called the testimony and the methods into question. Instead, the prosecutors assumed that the daycare was the center of ongoing satanic rituals. The utter lack of physical evidence, it's hard to sacrifice animals and murder people without leaving anything behind, should have also given them pause. Instead, the Kellers were convicted and sentenced to 48 years in prison. They were released in 2013 after 21 years when a judge ruled that their conviction resulted from faulty testimony by an expert witness. It gets worse. Many people have been sent to prison based on testimony given through facilitated communication, FC. This is the equivalent of spectral evidence, as FC is not a legitimate method. But it still has its true believers who think they can communicate with severely mentally disabled individuals by holding their hand and moving it over a letterboard or equivalent. Studies have shown that the facilitator and not the client is doing the communicating. And yet FC testimony has been allowed in court. There are also many entertaining examples of witch hunts in fiction. This is a powerful plot device because the audience may know that the accusations are false and see how injustice results from angry crowds and the suspension of the rules of evidence, or the audience may not know, in which case they experience the same uncertainty as the characters they are following. These modern examples are at the extreme end of the spectrum, but it's important to understand the structure of a witch hunt because witch hunts can manifest in subtle ways. It takes vigilance to consistently apply fair rules of evidence and logic to any accusation, no matter how upsetting. Perhaps my favorite example is from the video game Fallout 4. The synths are artificial humans who are replacing real people with perfect doppelgangers. This means anyone could be a synth, and perhaps all you have to go on is a vague feeling. Better kill them just to be sure. Chapter 27. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Placebo Effects. Placebo effects refer to an apparent response to a treatment or intervention that is due to something other than a biological response to an active treatment. Placebo heals nothing. There are no potentially powerful inner pathways by which placebo heals. At best, when lied to, you will feel better. Mark Crislip. Radioactive tonics were popular in the early 20th century, reaching their peak in the 1920s. Radioactivity had recently been discovered and still seemed new and sexy. This was before the atom bomb made radioactivity very scary. People extolled the many health benefits of radium or radioactive water while it was slowly poisoning them. This isn't an isolated historical incident. Also in the early 20th century, Albert Abrams, M.D., began selling a black box called a dynamizer that, he claimed, could diagnose any disease by using radio waves. Like radiation, radio was seen as new and high-tech. Abrams followed up his fake diagnostic device with the oscilloclast, which used those same radio waves to treat illness. Thousands of practitioners leased and used these machines, and millions of patients swore by their effects. Yet in 1924, Scientific American and the American Medical Association published the results of their investigations, concluding, "Analyzed in the cold light of scientific knowledge, the entire Abrams matter is the height of absurdity. The so-called electronic reactions of Abrams do not exist, at least objectively. They are merely products of the Abrams practitioner's mind. At best, it is all an illusion. At worst, it is a colossal fraud." When the FDA finally cracked open some of Abrams' black boxes soon after his death, they found nothing but simple off-the-shelf electronics, no more complex than a doorbell. Don't think that such episodes are limited to the quaint past. The recent popularity of bracelets made of rubber and plastic that claim to improve athletic performance is arguably more absurd than these historical examples. How then do we explain how so many people could swear by the health benefits of demonstrably worthless or even harmful treatments? The answer is the placebo effect, or more precisely, placebo effects. What are placebo effects? The operational definition of a placebo effect is any positive health effect measured after an intervention that is something other than a physiological response to a biologically active treatment. Negative effects from an inert treatment are called nocebo effects. In clinical trials, the placebo effect is any measured response in the group of study subjects that received an inert treatment, such as a sugar pill. However, quote, "the placebo effect is a misnomer and contributes to confusion, because it's not a single effect, but the net result of many possible factors. The various influences that contribute to a measured or perceived placebo effect vary depending upon the situation. What symptoms or outcomes are being observed? Subjective outcomes like pain, fatigue, and an overall sense of well-being are subject to a host of psychological factors. For example, subjects in clinical studies want to get better. They want to believe they're on the active experimental treatment and that it works. They want to feel that the time and effort they have invested is worthwhile, and they want to make the researchers happy. In turn, the researchers want their treatment to work and want to see their patients get better. So there is often a large reporting bias. In other words, subjects are likely to convince themselves they feel better and to report that they feel better, even if they don't. Also, those conducting a trial will tend to make biased observations in favor of a positive effect. It has been clearly demonstrated that subjects who are being studied in a clinical trial objectively do get better. This is precisely because they are in a clinical trial. They're paying closer attention to their overall health, likely taking better care of themselves due to the constant reminders concerning their health, and habits provided by the study visits and the attention they are getting, being examined on a regular basis by a physician, and their overall compliance with treatment is higher than usual. Basically, subjects in a clinical trial take better care of themselves and get more medical attention than people not in trials. For those not in a clinical trial, once they decide to do something about their health by starting a new treatment, they're likely to engage in more healthful behavior in other ways. There is also a statistical phenomenon called regression to the mean. In any varying system, which could be athletic performance or the waxing and waning of symptoms of a chronic illness, any extreme variance is statistically likely to be followed by a more typical variance. This means that when you have bad symptoms, it's likely that your symptoms will eventually become milder or regress to the mean. This also means that any treatment you take when your symptoms are severe is likely to be followed by a lessening of those symptoms, creating the illusion that the treatment worked. A similar phenomenon occurs when a person has long-standing symptoms and tries different treatments sequentially. They keep trying treatments until the symptoms improve or resolve. Then they credit the most recent treatment for the improvement. A common belief is that the placebo effect is largely a mind-over-matter effect, but this is a misconception. There's no compelling evidence that the mind can create healing simply through will or belief. However, mood and belief can have a significant effect on the subjective perception of pain. There is no method to directly measure pain as a phenomenon, and studies of pain are dependent upon the subjective reports of those being treated. There is therefore a large potential for perception and reporting bias in pain trials. But there are biological mechanisms by which mental processes can affect pain. For example, increased physical activity can release endorphins that naturally inhibit pain. The perception of pain can also be decreased by simple distraction. Even cursing reduces reported pain intensity. For these reasons, the placebo effect for pain is typically high, around 30%. The more concrete and physiological the outcome, the smaller the placebo effect. Survival of serious forms of cancer, for example, has no demonstrable placebo effect. There is a clinical trial effect, as described previously. Being a subject in a trial tends to improve care and compliance, but no placebo effect beyond that. There is no compelling evidence that mood or thought alone can help fight off cancer or any similar disease. Because there's a common and misleading assumption that placebo effects require the belief that a treatment will work, they don't. People further assume there is no placebo effect for animals or babies. However, the illusory effects of regression to the mean and the non-specific effects of getting attention are also in play. Further, someone has to decide if the horse or baby is better, and their assessment can be biased and therefore contribute to a measured placebo effect. There has been increasing research on placebo effects in recent years. Researchers want to know, for example, how much of what we see as a placebo effect is a biological improvement, and how much is just subjective reporting and illusion. Perhaps the most direct demonstration of this difference was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2011 by Michael Wexler et al. They compared albuterol, a drug for asthma, a placebo, sham acupuncture, placing the needles in the, quote, wrong locations, and no treatment in the management of asthma attacks, and measured both subjective and objective response. There are two graphs in the PDF that tell the story. As you will see, subjects reported that they felt better with the placebo treatments, a fake drug or fake acupuncture, but when their breathing function was measured, there was no actual improvement. Only the real drug improved lung function. This is potentially dangerous. An acute asthma attack can be fatal if it's untreated. A patient may convince themselves they feel better with a placebo treatment and delay going to the ER, while their lung function continues to decline. The Wexler et al. Study is fairly representative of the medical research in general. Placebo effects are subjective, illusory, and short-lived. They don't produce real healing. Any real benefits that contribute to the placebo effect can be gained by more straightforward methods, like healthy habits, compliance with treatment, and good health care. The placebo effect isn't evidence for any mysterious mind-over-matter effect. But since the mind is matter, the brain, and is connected to the rest of the body, there are some known physiological effects that do play a role, although often greatly exaggerated. In light of all this, it doesn't seem as if placebo effects are sufficient to justify magical, disproven, or highly implausible treatments. Keep in mind, you can get the same placebo effects from science-based treatments. You don't need to believe in magic. That is exactly what the proponents of all kinds of medical pseudoscience claim, however. They are happy to assert, without evidence, that their treatments have real effects, whether it is homeopathy, which is just water, energy medicine, or coffee enemas. Once scientific studies show their treatments are no better than placebo, meaning they don't work, then the proponents claim that this is okay because placebos work too. In a sense, much of so-called alternative medicine practice is placebo medicine, using elaborate rituals with fanciful explanations to produce nothing but imaginary placebo effects. This strategy depends on the misperception of placebo effects as being real mind-over-matter effects, when in fact they are mostly illusion and deception. As cliché as this is, the placebo emperor has no clothes. Chapter 28. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Anecdote. An anecdote is a story or experience, often offered as evidence, that was not controlled and is therefore subject to a host of biases and confounding factors. It is considered the weakest form of evidence, useful only for generating, but not testing, hypotheses. Anecdotal evidence leads us to conclusions that we wish to be true, not conclusions that actually are true. Barry Beierstein. While attending a lecture by a naturopath at my institution, I had the opportunity to ask the following question. Given the extreme scientific implausibility of homeopathy and the overall negative clinical evidence, why do you continue to prescribe homeopathic remedies? The answer, as much as my question, exposed a core difference between scientific and sectarian healthcare providers. She said, quote, "Because I have seen it work in my practice." There it is. She and many other practitioners of dubious modalities are compelled by anecdotal experience, while I am not. Scientists and skeptics have come to use the word anecdotal as a derogatory dismissal of certain kinds of weak evidence, and with good reason. Believers in the paranormal and unscientific healing modalities chafe at this and have rushed to the defense of anecdotal evidence, as it is often the only substance out of which they construct their fantasies and attempt to pass them off as science. Dr. David Katz, who hosted the naturopath I just quoted, thinks that we need to have a, quote, more fluid concept of evidence in medicine. By fluid, you can interpret weaker anecdotal forms of evidence. This difference in attitude toward anecdotal evidence is a persistent and critical difference between skeptics and believers. So it's important to understand why skeptics, by which I mean most scientists, don't trust anecdotal evidence. One of the hard-won lessons of the process of scientific discovery is that anecdotal evidence is very unreliable. Anecdotes can be worse than worthless because they can be misleading. This conclusion was arrived at after centuries of being misled by anecdotes. Treatments seem to work and then later are shown to be useless or even harmful. Common experience leads us to believe in many things that more carefully collected evidence later disproves. After being hit on the head so many times by anecdotal evidence throughout history, modern scientists are now appropriately wary. What we mean exactly by anecdotal evidence is the report of an experience by one or more persons that is not objectively documented, or an experience or outcome that occurred outside of a controlled environment. Such evidence is unreliable because it depends upon the accurate perception of the witness or witnesses, often in a situation where the event was unexpected or unusual. It is dependent upon subjective memory, which has overwhelmingly proven to be extremely error-prone and subject to a host of flaws. and it cannot account for the random vagaries of a chaotic world. As we've already learned, our perceptions and memories are constructed narratives loosely based on reality. Memories then change over time, with the details shifting to fit the narrative. There is also confirmation bias, a tendency to selectively remember information that supports the narrative. Casual observations also rarely contain objective measurements or quantification. Finally, even the most careful observation can't be generalized because it represents only one or a few cases. The results may be quirky, even a fluke, and not statistically representative. Data are only reliable when they systematically count, measure, and record all outcomes. That is scientific evidence. At this point in the history of science, with all that's gone before, it is hopelessly naive to put any faith in anecdotal evidence. It's utter folly to use such weak and flawed evidence as a basis for concluding that a new and unusual phenomenon is real, and that our science textbooks need to be rewritten. At best, anecdotes can be used as an indication of a possible, not even probable, phenomenon that is deserving of further research or exploration. It can be used to generate a hypothesis, but it shouldn't be used as a basis to confirm one. This opinion is generally accepted within the scientific community, yet in everyday life we tend to rely heavily on anecdotes, especially our own. If I take a treatment and then feel better, that seems like powerful evidence that the treatment worked. You cannot draw this conclusion, however. Perhaps I would have felt better anyway. Maybe I even would have felt better faster without the treatment. The only way to know is to look at many people taking the treatment versus a fake treatment, placebo, under controlled and blinded conditions, and then compare all outcomes. We learn to trust our anecdotal experience for a few reasons. For everyday simple things, it's a simple and efficient approach. We don't have the time or resources to conduct a scientific experiment on every little aspect of our lives. If the milk goes sour when I leave it out of the fridge, I conclude that the milk needs to be refrigerated. I wouldn't test this systematically unless I had some reason to doubt this conclusion. The conclusion may even be wrong, but it's not worth the effort to test it. We are also predisposed to believe stories, especially when they have an emotional theme. Perhaps this is a result of our evolution. Let's say your friend tells you to avoid the valley over the ridge because a large lion is hunting there. We probably descended from those who chose to believe their friend and not those who decided to go to the valley and check it out for themselves. In other words, selective pressures may favor accepting stories as probably true as a default. Defenders of anecdotal evidence will often claim that since it's reliable for everyday mundane experiences, we can therefore rely upon anecdotes more generally. I think this is both a false premise and a false analogy. Everyday experience can be misleading. There are numerous psychological experiments, mostly designed to look at memory, that have documented the fact that in everyday encounters, our anecdotal recollections of events are extremely flawed. And as we've been discussing, our interpretation of events is even more flawed, subject to a host of psychological factors. Further, we now live in a complex technological civilization. We're asking very sophisticated questions, and anecdotal evidence just isn't up to the task of answering them. The price of accepting what is not true, such as a worthless medical treatment working, can be very high. Much like our ancient ancestors, we might be tempted to accept an anecdotal report from an alleged, quote, credible witness. But the credible witness is now just as much a myth as Bigfoot. We are all humans. We all have flawed and biased brains. Being an airline pilot, for example, doesn't change the way your brain processes visual information. Some witnesses are certainly better than others, but any witness can be fooled. Even when multiple witnesses insist they saw the same thing, this could be accounted for by memory contamination. It's common for eyewitnesses, especially if they were together at the time, to talk during and after the experience about what they were seeing. The perceptions of one person can thereby easily contaminate the memory of the other witnesses. Being in an uncompromised state of mind is a necessary but insufficient criterion for reliability. Even someone who is wide awake and uncompromised can make profound errors in perception and interpretation. Also, people often underestimate the effects on their mental state of factors such as moderate sleep deprivation. Gullible ghost hunters routinely find that if they stay up all night in an allegedly haunted house, eventually weird things start happening. The bottom line is this. We know for certain from countless historical examples that even people who have all the traits of a reliable witness can be profoundly mistaken. Why would they lie? I'm often asked if I think a purveyor of obvious nonsense is a con artist or a true believer. Of course, I often cannot know for sure, unless they're caught red-handed in fraud, and I suspect that many are a combination of the two to some degree. But it is often argued by believers that if you can't either prove that someone is lying or clearly identify an ulterior motive, they must be telling the truth, or at least are believable. Clearly, whether or not someone believes what they are reporting says nothing about the accuracy of the information, just that they're not willfully lying. But believers miss some important possible motivations for prevarication. First, people sometimes stretch the truth simply because it makes life more interesting. It breaks the dull routine of our mundane lives for others to believe that we saw a ghost or were abducted by aliens, and that's motivation enough. Others may commit pious fraud. They are true believers, but they may embellish their experiences in order to convince those nasty skeptics. This is like a cop planting evidence on a suspect they know to be guilty, to make sure justice is done. And finally, people just do weird things for weird reasons. The inability to figure out why someone might lie is no reassurance that they are in fact telling the truth. An argument from ignorance, right? The simple fact is that selected memories of uncontrolled quirky observations, anecdotes, are extremely unreliable. They may be suitable for simple aspects of our everyday lives, but not for anything of true importance. They certainly don't suffice as scientific evidence or to establish entirely new phenomena. Iconic cautionary tales from history. One of the more memorable lectures I heard in medical school involved a story from when the professor was an intern in Israel. He was treating a seriously ill patient who had all manner of laboratory abnormalities, including the fact that most of his electrolytes, ionized substances in the blood like sodium, chloride, and potassium, were severely out of the normal range. He spent the night carefully adjusting the intravenous fluid and giving electrolytes until the numbers were all in the normal range. By the morning, despite the professor's best efforts, the patient died. His supervising doctor chastised him, stating, "You corrected the electrolytes but killed the Israelite." In addition to the pithy rebuke, the story contained an important cautionary lesson. Don't get so focused on fixing the numbers that you miss the big picture. Treat the patient, not just the laboratory findings. There is a meta lesson here, too. Learn from your mistakes, or better yet, learn from other people's mistakes. The professor wanted us to learn from his mistake and not have to lose our own patience to absorb that lesson. This lesson reflects a more general observation credited to George Santayana. Those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it. Part of the duty of activist skeptics is to remember the history of science, pseudoscience, deception, and fraud. The same mistakes, errors in thinking, biases, and cons keep getting recycled. The skeptical lessons of the past are still relevant today, and studying their history is an easy way to learn from the mistakes of others. The public may be impressed by claims made for magnetic bracelets, but they are no different than the magnetic snake oil devices that were popular 200 years ago. All the pseudosciences we confront today have their roots in the past. The work of scientists and skeptics in previous decades can act like a vaccine, allowing us to mount a more rapid and robust response to fraud and quackery today. In this final section of Core Skeptical Concepts, we will explore some common deceptions, iconic blunders of the past, and examples of classic pseudoscience. These examples will bring together many of the ideas we have already discussed and allow us to flex our critical thinking muscles. We will see how things can go horribly wrong when people are less than skeptical. And I promise that no Israelites will be killed in the process. Chapter 29. Skeptic's Guide entry, The Clever Hans Effect. The Clever Hans Effect refers to an unconscious, nonverbal communication of information from a researcher or agent to an animal or other subject. This unconscious communication creates the illusion of a cognitive or supernatural ability. Fables should be taught as fables, myths as myths, and miracles as poetic fantasies. To teach superstitions as truths is a most terrible thing. The child mind accepts and believes them, and only through great pain and perhaps tragedy can he be in later years relieved of them. Hypatia. It can be fun to think that there's a lot more going on inside the minds of animals than there probably is. We have a tendency to project and anthropomorphize, talking to our pets as if they understand what we are saying. To a limited extent, they do, but not enough to justify our one-sided dialogues. This tendency might also be a partial explanation for why books like the Dr. Doolittle series, definitely a childhood favorite of mine, are so popular. In the world of Dr. Doolittle, animals have human-level intelligence, and we simply don't understand their language. The first book in the series was published in 1920, at a time when fascination with the concept that animals might have vast, unrecognized cognition was near peak level. This, in turn, is thought to be the result of the rising acceptance of Darwin's theory of evolution. If humans are intimately connected to the rest of the animal kingdom, perhaps animals are more human than we previously thought. It was against this historical background, in 1904 to be precise, that Wilhelm von Osten introduced his horse, Clever Hans, to the world. Wilhelm von Osten was a mathematician, but perhaps more importantly, he is described as an amateur horse trainer, a phrenologist, discerning personality from the bumps on the skull, and a mystic. Von Osten spent 2 years training Hans to read. You heard that correctly, read. Von Osten created a board with each letter of the alphabet associated with a number. He would then say a letter and hold Hans's hoof as he tapped out the corresponding number of times. Over time, he gradually withdrew his hand and let Hans stomp his hoof by himself. In this way, Hans apparently learned how to spell out words and eventually entire sentences. Of course, once Hans could communicate in words, then you could ask him questions. Through this technique, von Osten taught Hans to tell time, interpret a calendar, understand music theory, and do arithmetic. Take that, Mr. Ed. Hans became an instant sensation in Germany, and then worldwide. He impressed not only the crowds, but also the scientific community. Hans was observed by a psychiatrist, Gustav Wolff, who declared himself convinced that an animal can think in a human way and can express human ideas in human language. Other scholars and scientists were similarly astounded. While the idea of a horse with apparent human-level intelligence seems implausible, how could they deny the evidence of their own eyes? Hans could tap out the answers to all sorts of questions. The scientists even did a reasonable control. They tested Hans while von Osten was not present, and he was still able to perform. In their minds, this ruled out any possibility of fraud. Of course, the story of Clever Hans does not end there. Oscar Fungst from the University of Berlin's Psychological Institute did a more detailed investigation of his alleged abilities. Fungst added a further control that no one else had thought to do. He made sure that no one who knew the answer to the question Hans was asked was in the room with him. In this situation, Hans would slowly tap, looking at the people present, but would just continue to tap without end. It appeared as if Hans was waiting for a signal that never arrived. His amazing abilities vanished entirely when this control was put into place. Fungst concluded that during the extensive training of Hans, the horse learned to pick up on subtle cues from his trainer when he hit the target number of stomps on the ground. So he would just keep stomping until he got the signal. There is no indication that von Osten was aware he was giving such cues, and in fact Hans was able to pick up on cues from people other than his trainer. A cautionary tale. The story of Clever Hans contains several lessons for the skeptic. The most narrow lesson is to be especially careful when researching animal communication. It's incredibly easy to overinterpret what animals are doing and to impose human intellect on our non-human friends. The Clever Hans effect has in fact plagued animal communication research over the last century. It seems every generation has to relearn the lessons of Clever Hans. More broadly, this episode is evidence for the so-called observer expectancy effect. It's a special case of this more general effect, which simply refers to the influence a researcher or observer can have on what they are observing. Researchers can unwittingly communicate their biases or expectations to the subjects of their study, distorting the outcome. This is the primary reason for the need for properly blinded experiments. In the case of Clever Hans, observers falsely assumed that only the trainer could be the source of nonverbal cues, allowing Hans to simulate having human intelligence. The effect was only detected when all possible sources were eliminated. Finally, this episode is yet more evidence of why it's critical to consider plausibility when interpreting evidence. Von Austen, who likely did not give deep consideration to scientific plausibility, given that he was a phrenologist and a mystic, obviously began training Hans with the idea that he could learn how to read. This quickly evolved into a theory that Hans could also perform math, grasp complex concepts, and even understand abstract music theory. When a finding becomes more and more amazing, it's possible that you are chasing an artifact, an illusion caused by bad research methods rather than a real phenomenon. The apparent abilities of Hans should have made von Austen more skeptical and brought much more caution to the scientists who endorsed the horse's ability. Similarly, the inability to identify such an artifact doesn't mean that the alleged phenomenon is real. See the argument from ignorance in Chapter 10. In cases of extreme scientific implausibility, it's perhaps best to withhold judgment until truly expert investigation can be done and results can be independently replicated. Such a position isn't closed-minded. It is simply realistic. If something seems too fantastical to be true, history tells us it is extremely likely that it's not true, that it's just an illusion, an error, or an artifact of flawed methodology. At the very least, all such possibilities should be ruled out to a degree that is in proportion with the implausibility of the claim. It is clear that von Austen, Gustav Wolff, and the other scientists who declared Clever Hans legitimate did so prematurely, and now their legacy is being on the wrong side of a cautionary tale, or tail, T-A-I-L, if you prefer. The lesson of Clever Hans is critical to keep in mind the next time a gushing reporter or enthusiastic researcher promotes the apparently impossible. Such stories often come with the challenge to explain that skeptic. Give it time. Chapter 30. Skeptic's Guide Entry, The Hawthorne Effect. The Hawthorne, or observer effect, refers to the fact that simply observing something may alter its behavior, thereby creating an artifact that leads to an incorrect conclusion. The universal propensity of humans to learn is a constant threat in almost every experiment on people. Stephen Draper. The story of the Hawthorne effect, the notion that observers affect the outcome of what they are observing, is a complicated one. It is an excellent demonstration of the fundamental rule that it's always more complicated than you think. If there is one overall lesson I have learned after 20 years as a science communicator, that's it. There is a general bias towards oversimplification, which to some extent is an adaptive behavior. The universe is massive and complicated, and it would be a fool's errand to try to understand every aspect of it down to the tiniest detail. We tend to understand the world through distilled narratives, simple stories that approximate reality, whether we know it or not, or whether we intend to or not. Those distilled narratives can be very useful, as long as you understand that they are simplified approximations, and don't confuse them with a full and complete description of reality. Different levels of expertise can partly be defined as the degree of complexity of the models of reality that you use. It's also interesting to think about the optimal level of complexity for your own purposes. I try to take a deliberate, practical approach here. To what degree of complexity do I need to know? The Hawthorne Effect. The distilled narrative of the Hawthorne Effect is this. The act of observing people's behavior changes that behavior. This is a more general phenomenon of which the Clever Hans Effect is a special case, in which the observer unwittingly communicates information to the observed. The name Hawthorne Effect, coined in 1953 by psychologist J.R.P. French, derives from experiments conducted between 1924 and 1933 in Western Electric's factory at Hawthorne, a suburb of Chicago. The experimenters made various changes to the working environment, like adjusting light levels, and noticed that regardless of the change, performance improved. If they increased light levels, performance improved. If they decreased light levels, performance improved. They eventually concluded that observing the workers was leading to the enhanced performance, and the actual change in working conditions was irrelevant. This is now referred to as an observer effect. For most people, that one paragraph is a nice bit of knowledge and is probably all they're going to remember long term. But of course, it's more complicated than that. Science communicators often try to take that one paragraph basic knowledge and raise it to a more thorough and nuanced one essay knowledge, the level of a science enthusiast or, in this case, scientific skeptic. But there are deeper levels still, representing various degrees of expertise. The trick is to be essentially correct at each level of approximation. The problem is that most one-paragraph summaries in the public consciousness are not essentially correct. Sometimes more detail and nuance are needed to get to an acceptable level of correctness. Knowing where that level resides is part of the skill of science communication. And here we return to Hawthorne. I have heard conflicting statements about the Hawthorne effect and tried to understand the science deeply enough to resolve those apparent conflicts and arrive at an essentially correct and sufficiently nuanced summary of the research. Here is what I found. Starting with a recent systematic review of the published literature, always a good place to begin, and the results and conclusion of a 2014 review. Results. 19 purposefully designed studies were included, providing quantitative data on the size of the effect in 8 randomized controlled trials, 5 quasi-experimental studies, and 6 observational evaluations of reporting on one's behavior by answering questions or being directly observed and being aware of being studied. Although all but one study was undertaken within health sciences, study methods, contexts, and findings were highly heterogeneous. Most studies reported some evidence of an effect, although significant biases are judged likely because of the complexity of the evaluation object. Conclusion. Consequences of research participation for behaviors being investigated do exist, although little can be securely known about the conditions under which they operate, their mechanisms of effects, or their magnitudes. New concepts are needed to guide empirical studies. From reading this and other reviews, it seems that the evidence over the last century clearly shows that there is an experimenter effect when observing human behavior in social settings, like the workplace. This experimenter effect, however, isn't entirely an observer effect, a response to knowing that one is being observed. The term Hawthorne effect, therefore, has come to refer to a more general experimenter artifact. Some more detail on the Hawthorne experiments is interesting and provides further background. They spent 5 years adjusting light levels for thousands of employees, with control groups in which they didn't adjust light levels. In general, every time they made a change, there was an increase in productivity, regardless of the actual change. Both the control and active groups improved without statistical difference. This was true as long as the actual light levels didn't produce a material problem. When, for example, they dropped the light level so low it became difficult to see, the workers complained. They also varied the duration of breaks and the intervals between them with the same results. They gave shorter work days, which increased productivity per hour, although if they decreased them too much, daily productivity decreased. There have been other experiments that help put these results into further context. In a series of teacher expectation experiments, for instance, teachers were told that one set of students performed well on an aptitude test and were expected to perform well in the class. Over the next 2 years, those students performed better than the other students, even though the groups were actually equal at the onset. Further, the teachers sometimes expressed annoyance at students in the low expectation group who did very well, exceeding expectations. There were also the 1900 punch card experiments of psychologist Joseph Jastrow. One group of workers in the U.S. Census Bureau were told that their quota on the tabulating machines was 550 punch cards per day, which they were able to produce. When asked to increase their quota, they indicated that this would be too difficult. A second group were told nothing, and they produced 2,100 punch cards per day. How to interpret all this? Clearly, there are some interesting psychological effects going on here. To say this is all an observer effect would be a gross oversimplification, to the point of being wrong by missing important other effects. One such possibility is expectation, which is evident in the teacher and punch card experiments. Teachers have great influence on the performance of their students, although it's still not clear exactly what the mechanisms are. That influence is biased by expectations, which is exactly why so much attention is paid to gender and race biases in teachers. It's also why we have to be very careful with labels and with using possibly biased standardized tests to establish expectations. In the punch card experiments, there seems to be a self-expectation bias. People's perception of what is reasonable and even possible was easily established by creating a set point. I think this would now be described as part of the anchoring heuristic. Expectations can be anchored to a specific value, and later judgments then use that anchor as a reference point. Setting a quota is a strong manifestation of anchoring expectations. More recently, researchers have been thinking about the social and community aspects of these effects. Essentially, there is a work culture that influences the behavior of those in the group. That culture is altered by many variables, including the anchoring of expectations. Being observed and feeling as if management is taking an interest in your work conditions or that you have some say in those conditions will also have an effect. The very notion that someone upstairs cares about details like the light level in your working space may have a profound effect on the work culture. Workers also influence each other. They establish norms of behavior and expectations for standards and productivity. In fact, the expectations of fellow workers may have more of an impact on behavior than management. Modern corporate culture makes extensive use of consultants. A consulting firm will come in, observe the work culture of a company, then make recommendations based upon some theory or their alleged expertise. Productivity almost always improves after such interventions. It's possible that this corporate self-help industry is essentially selling the Hawthorne effect, even if their specific recommendations are speculative, nonsensical, or counterproductive. This is all very similar to the placebo effect. Both placebo effects and Hawthorne effects are multiple effects that can be difficult to tease apart. They can also both be used to create the illusion of a specific response to a specific intervention, when in fact they are just nonspecific responses to the act of having any intervention and assessing the outcome. The self-help industry is largely selling placebo Hawthorne effects as well. If people go on a diet, for example, the details of their diet don't seem to matter, again, like the light levels, as long as they're not so extreme as to create a functional problem. The fact that they are paying attention to what they eat and trying to be more active has an effect. The bottom line of all this is that any intervention in almost any context will subjectively seem to work. There are a host of observational and psychological factors that will result in a real change in behavior, but also a biased assessment of the results. This often leads to the false conclusion that the specific intervention, a treatment, a diet, a self-help strategy, or whatever, has specific efficacy, and therefore the underlying philosophy must be valid. The Hawthorne placebo effect, interpreted broadly, is extremely far-reaching. The question it almost invariably raises is, can this type of effect be used in an ethical and positive way? I think the short answer is, it depends. It's more complicated than you probably think. there are many pitfalls and downstream effects, and many things to consider. My quick summary would be, in the context of medicine, I would not justify any intervention simply because it provokes placebo effects alone. In other contexts, such as making changes in the workplace, I wouldn't do anything that goes against common sense, that seems extreme, or that violates normal ethical conduct just because it seems to create some improved outcome. However, benign and reasonable interventions, even if they have no specific effect, may be a sensible way to make people feel like you are paying attention, that you care, that their voice is being heard, and may therefore improve the culture of the workplace. Just don't buy into some wacky underlying theory just because the intervention seems to help. For researchers, the challenge is to separate real specific effects from non-specific artifacts of doing research or making an intervention. At this point, reality is more complex than even the experts have a handle on. Chapter 31. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Cold Reading. Cold reading is a collection of mentalism techniques used to create the illusion of having gained specific knowledge about a target through supernatural means. The techniques involve use of vague statements, high probability guesswork, and feeding back knowledge gained from the subject themselves, while the target makes connections to their own personal experience. Cold reading is used in stage magic for entertainment, but also by a wide variety of less honest practitioners to feign psychic or arcane abilities. It is probably a tribute to the creativity of the human mind that a client can, under the right circumstances, make sense out of almost any reading and manage to fit it to his or her own unique situation. All that is necessary is that the reader make out a plausible case for why the reading ought to fit. The client will do the rest. Ray Hyman. I am getting a vision. Of you. That's right, of you, dear listener. As I read these words, I am making a connection through time and space. Through this audiobook, through your ears, and into the very essence of your existence. I see a person. Someone close to you, an older male figure, and the letter J or perhaps S. It's hard to see, as I am connecting to more than one listener at a time. I see a uniform of some kind, and there is a strong, distinctive odor about him. And why am I seeing a red door? Does this have any meaning to you? The number 3 is significant. It could be a day, or month, or part of a year. This person wants to connect to you, to let you know they love you, and that they are all right. This is, of course, nothing but a cold reading, a clever stage illusion. Cold reading is at the heart of a long list of practices that pretend to use either supernatural or arcane means to divine special knowledge about a person. Cold reading is about more than just fake psychics, but I repeat myself. At a medical conference, for example, a pharmaceutical company offered free handwriting analysis for entertainment, of course. Always game, I agreed to have the depths of my personality laid bare, betrayed by the sweep of my S and the boldness of my T. To my skeptical eye, the results were laughably mundane and predictable. The reader knew, of course, that I was a physician, so it was no surprise when he read in my handwriting that I like science and have a desire to care for people. Wow. But others were impressed by the apparent accuracy of their readings. The results aren't dissimilar from many friends and acquaintances who have visited a local psychic, tarot card reader, or astrologer, and the many more who have seen TV psychics like John Edward and Sylvia Brown. How do you explain this, people ask, very impressed, convinced that something paranormal must be going on. Like any magic trick, a good performance can seem amazing, even inexplicable. Once you know how the trick is done, however, it becomes embarrassingly mundane. So let's have a peek. The basics of cold reading involve starting with general statements that are likely to be true about anyone. I see you have financial concerns. You feel as if no one truly understands you. Your family has been on your mind a lot recently. Such vague assertions can seem quite specific when someone is applying them to you. As you nod and express amazement, the reader makes other comments, following up on only those statements that garner a good reaction. The psychic says, "Maybe your sister, or an aunt, definitely a woman close to you. and he or she watches for your reactions to gauge when the trail is getting warm. Working this way, in a few moments, the cold reader is telling you your most intimate secrets. A cold reader may also start with a general statement and then, once the subject answers positively or negatively, follow up with a more specific statement, pretending that's what they had in mind all the time. For example, they may claim to see the letter J. A willing participant might then dutifully fill in the detail of John. The reader will pick up on this and say, "Yes, John, I see a male figure named John who was important in your life." "John is my father," the subject may volunteer. "Yes," continues the reader, "because I see that he is an older man, and he was with you as a child." But after the reading, the subject will likely tell others that the psychic knew his father's name was John. Framing the statements as questions is also very effective. "Do you live on a hill?" If the target or sitter answers yes, then the reader will follow up with, "I was afraid of that, because I see danger involving an accident on that hill." If the sitter answers no, the reader may say, "I didn't think so, because I see a home in a valley or in a flat place." Whatever the target answers, the reader can pretend that's what they saw all along. Another strategy is to make high probability guesses. For example, cold readers will commonly see the letters J and M, or actually guess the names John or Mary, because they are so common. Watch TV psychics carefully. They never see the letter Q. They may tell an elderly, affluent New Englander that they see palm trees in the near future. So-called psychic detectives will often see water or a red door, items that seem specific but are common enough that they're likely to be found somewhere near the eventual location of the victim. John Edward is fond of guessing, "I see the number 3. It can be a month or a day or part of a year." He will keep going until he gets a hit. These types of guesses are generally unspecific, but they give the illusion of being highly specific once the target of the reading makes the connection to something in their lives. Another common guess is to see a person in uniform. That may sound like a direct, specific hit if your father, or whatever person you are trying to contact, was in the army. But a uniform can also refer to a letter carrier, a lab technician, a police officer, or a firefighter. And again, once the target makes the connection, the cold reader will pretend that's what they saw all along. Going from vague statements to specific examples when connecting a guess to yourself is a known psychological phenomenon. It was first described by the psychologist Bertram R. Forer in 1949, and is now known as the Forer effect, although it's also often called the Barnum effect after the famous carnival showman. Forer gave his students what he told them was a personality profile specifically created for each individual based on their test results. The students rated the accuracy of the profiles on average as 4.26 out of 5. They were only later told that every student received identical personality profiles. Follow-up research by other psychologists confirms this effect but also demonstrates that people will rank vague statements as being more accurate than more specific statements. Subjects will even rank vague generic statements more highly than specific statements generated from validated and thorough questionnaires. Other factors that make a fake personality profile seem real are if the subject believes the profile applies to them. They believe in the authority of the source, and the statements are mostly positive. All of these factors apply to cold readings. Readers pretend the information is specific to the target. They carefully craft their persona and the atmosphere of the reading to create the proper mystique of authority. And they mainly tell people what they want to hear. Strangely, you never hear psychics give clients readings such as, "You are never going to find true love or happiness. In your job, you will only manage to struggle your way up to middle management, where you will labor away until you retire or die. Your ordinary life will be punctuated by occasional tragedy, but nothing truly exciting will ever occur." Experienced cold readers are very knowledgeable about statistics, the most common names, jobs, or eye color. That kind of statistical information is useful for other mentalist tricks, too. Mentalists may know very specific things. For example, knowing that most airlines have red in their logo allows them to predict, about an airline crash, "I see red on the tail." Skilled cold readers may also remember information blurted out by their targets early in the reading, which they will ignore and then feed back to them later as if they divined the information themselves. Cold readers are opportunistic and observant. A co-worker, skeptical about cold reading as an explanation for alleged psychic performances,